Welcome to WITCAST, the podcast of the Women Inside Trade Network, an international organization that contributes to the empowerment of women and seeks to address a gender gap that still exists in Brazil and in the world when it comes to international trade. We are going to discuss the Russian invasion of Ukraine, specifically on the matter of food supply and the impacts for the food industry. And we invited Emily Rees to discuss this topic from the European perspective. Emily Rees is a Brussels-based international trade policy expert, and she is the founder of Trade Strategies. She's an economist by training, but Emily's expertise lies at the intersection of trade, agriculture, and climate change. She is a Franco-British national. She comes from an extensive career in European affairs, trade policy, and economic diplomacy. Emily is also a senior fellow at the European Center for International Political Economy, where she leads the European Mercosur Project, a program to bridge trade relations between Europe and Latin America. Emily, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Marina. I mean, it's a real pleasure to be with you today on the WITCAST. And I mean, of course, if you'll allow me a couple of words before we kick off, I mean, first, as a European, I must express how devastating it is to see the return of war in Europe. There really is no legitimate reason to invade a sovereign country, killing civilians and destroying livelihoods. And of course, my thoughts today are therefore first and foremost with the brave Ukrainians who are leading this fight for the integrity of their land and democracy. But with that, I'm also very happy to talk about the food security implications with you today.
Thank you so much, Emily. As you know, besides the very sad implications from the humanitarian point of view, there are also obvious international law violations arising from the Russian aggression, and the conflict may result in severe consequences in the supply of agricultural products, especially grains, in Europe and many other countries, including China and the Middle East countries.
With that in mind, our first question regards the fact that both Ukraine and Russia are very relevant countries in terms of grain supply globally. Russia and Ukraine combined produce 14% of the global wheat and supply the exports of 29% of the wheat, 17% of the corn, and 14% of the barley exported globally. Thus, the Russian invasion in Ukraine may cause severe disruptions in the global supply of these grains. In this context, an increasing concern regarding the food security is rising since the invasion of Ukraine. Could you please comment on this situation and what are the possible measures that may be taken in order to avoid or minimize shortages?
Thanks, Deborah. I mean, that's a very dense question, so I'll try and split it apart. I mean, first, we know that Ukraine and Russia are both major agricultural producers and exporters, and any extended conflict will drive food prices to spiral upwards around the world. When we start considering aggregated shares in total global exports, the highest exposure actually is in vegetable oils, and particularly sunflower, safflower, and cottonseed oil, where both countries make up for 57% of world exports. Next in line, wheat, where, as you mentioned, Deborah, Russia and Ukraine combined are substantial actors in supplying the cereal, especially to the Mediterranean basin, with major food security implications, which I hope we'll be able to delve into a bit further today. The two countries also supply a quarter of the world's barley needs. That's a cereal that's often used to make bread, animal fodder, but is also the source of malt. So that's for the production of alcoholic beverages, such as beer, for instance. Linseed and corn are also very relevant in this context. For instance, half of the EU's imported corn comes from Ukraine, meaning that any disruption in access to market is going to drive inflation in segments such as animal proteins. Today, the EU 27 agricultural ministers are meeting in Brussels to discuss this point. Again, then with another consideration is that with men between the ages of 18 and 60 being called to volunteer in defending Ukraine's integrity, much depends on how long this conflict lasts. Barley, corn, millet, oats, buckwheat are all planted in April and May in Ukraine, so relatively soon, and they are harvested in the late summer. Wheat works slightly differently because it's planted at the end of last summer, and the harvest takes place in the summer months of July and August here in this part of the world. Either way, any disruption on the grains markets is going to have severe consequences for a number of countries. We know that. Egypt and Turkey depend on combined Russian and Ukrainian imports for 70% of their wheat supply. That's bread. Yemen, Libya, Lebanon also find themselves in a very particularly sensitive situation, as do Nigeria and Sudan. These countries are already facing food insecurity. If we look at the FAO's latest outlook, you know, and in many cases are facing outstanding conflicts that could worsen with food insecurity. Yeah, we need to put this into a situation where we are already in a place where the price of bread worldwide is at its highest since 2011, according to the FAO's food price index. And we know that the price of bread is very linked and conducive in many ways to questions of civil unrest around the world. So now, in turning to the question of what we can do to avoid and minimize shortages, I would gather that, I mean, in a way, we must first turn to the developing countries that are going to be most impacted. And a lot of the next steps are going to lay in the hands of development agencies, but also the UN's food program to minimize the impact in terms of food insecurity in a number of these countries that I've mentioned. But let's also see another part to this. Rising grain prices are also going to encourage some of the major cereal producers. And if we look at major wheat producers, for instance, such as China, India, the US, France, Australia, Canada, Germany, to expand the surfaces as the planting season starts at the end of this summer. I mean, in a way that could, yes, help to diminish slightly the impact. But I mean, I think we have to be very clear, the quantities that we're talking about will be disruptive and they will have a reverberation of effects worldwide.
Thank you, Emily. It's a pleasure to have you here and to discuss this difficult topic. I think in addition to what the scenario that you described right now, which is already very difficult for many, many countries and worldwide. I guess the follow-up question would be to understand a little bit the responses to the Russian aggression to Ukraine. I mean, we know several countries, the US, European Union, Switzerland, they have brought in sanctions to Russian exports and banking operations right now. So my question to you would be to understand a little bit on the implications of these sanctions in terms of food security. Are food items excluded from the sanctions, for example, or if so, is this enough to avoid any disruption on the food security, on the food supply chain? So what's the scenario that you bring to us in terms of this?
Thanks, Marina. I mean, from the viewpoint of Brussels, which is where I am, and so that's where I'm going to intervene from, I think it is fair to say that we're living in extraordinary times? I mean, in 1 week, we have seen governments change their historical policy positions in what in many ways being considered to be a watershed moment, particularly for defense policy, but not only. On Sunday, as you mentioned, EU member states agreed to a hard round of financial sanctions, the third package of sanctions on Russia. And this time, this package is set to target the Russian central bank's ability to access part of its reserves. And in effect, we've seen the Russian ruble already showing signs of tumbling. As we speak, diplomats are still hard at work in defining how far the SWIFT measure should go and which banks will effectively be cut off from global electronic payments. So it is, I would say, still a bit too early to provide a detailed overview of the impact. But what we do know is that Ukraine and Russia are mostly cut off from world trade in agricultural products, and that any humanitarian exemptions, and we'll touch on how that works, will take time to be put into place. Yeah. Beyond the banking and financial sanctions, I trust it's worth also taking a second to look at the private sector's response to this crisis. Europe's big ocean carriers, for instance, have simply suspended orders for shipments and are now already diverting cargoes to other destinations. Spot rates for shipping containers are soaring worldwide as we speak, and that's going to have dramatic effects in terms of a global spillover, as supply chains are only just recovering from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. As an example, I mean, Hapag-Lloyd is stopping taking orders for Ukraine cargo and has placed a temporary blocking suspension for shipments in and out of Russia. Maersk and MSC have taken the decision to apply a full suspension of all container bookings in and out of Russia, with Ukraine-bound freight currently being discharged in either Egypt or Turkey. So with financial transactions, in a way going to be mostly disabled, again, we have to see what the legal text will be as soon as they're available, and logistics in high disruption, many companies are simply going to take the decision to not supply these markets. And we're already seeing that happen in the consumer, in the fast moving consumer goods circuits, with a number of brands, I would say, deciding to simply not provide further shipments. And so this brings us to the question of humanitarian exemptions under sanctions, or as I'd like to say, how to separate carrots from caviar. The UN Security Council establishes the sanctions committees to monitor the implementation and effect of embargoes and sanctions and the categories of goods essential for the survival of the population victim of the conflict. I'm not a legal expert in humanitarian affairs, so I would really like to stand corrected on this point. But then, in my view, that obviously brings the valid question as to whether the humanitarian exemption should apply to the aggressor, or Russia in this case. Right now, what's happening at this stage is simply that the humanitarian aid is focused on getting supplies to the Polish border, where hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian women and children are flowing into the EU. It was 650,000 at latest count this morning, to seek haven from Russian missile strikes. A lot, I think, that will still be discussed. Perhaps, you know, this is really just the kickoff of these initial discussions as we see how the sanction regimes and the humanitarian exemptions will be carved out.
Thank you so much, Emily. I think the legal text will be available soon, probably, and then things will be a little more clear, but it was very nice hearing your perspectives on this, and we hope it's as short as possible for the sake of the population involved. And changing a little bit the subject, In your opinion, what are the impacts of these sanctions for Brazilian export of agricultural products? Since, as you mentioned, the humanitarian exemptions may take a while, could you please comment on how this would may impact Brazilian exports for Ukraine? And I don't know if maybe Russia, it's already off the table. So could you please talk a little bit about it?
Of course. Brazil should see prices soar in commodities where it competes with either Russia or Ukraine in world markets, such as corn. Around the world, companies are going to be rushing to find alternative sources of supply. And that means that, for instance, Brazilian corn is going to be sold at a premium. For downstream food processing industries in Brazil, reliant on corn or wheat, for instance, that's going to increase costs of production, right? Another factor to look into is also Brazil's dependency on fertilizer imports from Russia that support, you know, the country's agricultural productivity, but can also create inflationary pressures. So it's certainly an area to look out for. And again, early days in terms of the dynamics. But I believe the key question now is whether the increase in the cost of inputs will be outweighed by the premium that Brazil may gain in selling on international markets. And if you'll allow me to take an example, poultry, where Brazil is a world leader, yeah, nearly a quarter of European imports of poultry come from Ukraine, and Ukraine suppliers have effectively stopped supplying the EU, yeah, to funnel these products into defense efforts. So essentially, the production of chicken in Ukraine is now going to the army and to volunteers. The production is also being disrupted by the fact that, again, men between the age of 18 and 60 are taking up arms to defend the country's integrity and sovereignty. And that means that we don't even know if that part of production will occur, even if it's for the domestic market, or whether Ukraine will also be in a situation of a deficit in animal proteins. With this tightening of supply on the European market, we're talking about, yes, nearly 25% of EU imports. Essentially, it's true, the EU will be inclined to increase its imports from the two other major world players, which are Brazil and Thailand. So those are the types of, I would say, secondary effects of the tightening and oversupplies in markets that we're going to see. Now, there's another question, which is that the cutting off of Russia from SWIFT also means that Russian agricultural products are going to experience difficulties in exporting simply because the payments can't go through. And that with the exception of certain politically aligned markets. So a lot of the geopolitical innuendos of what's going to happen over the next few weeks is going to tell us what's going to happen in commodity markets. But we could imagine in any case that there will be a depreciation of Russian commodities as they will not be bought by many parts of the world. And that can undercut Brazilian exports in certain markets where there would be a political alignment, such as China, for instance. So on the question now that you mentioned of, you know, whether Brazil will be able to trade under humanitarian exemptions, I mean, again, to my earlier point, I would err on the side of caution. In principle, yes. But in practice, we know from other situations, that of Venezuela, of Iran, of Yemen, that the activity can become so cumbersome in terms of documentation, banking procedures, insurance, maritime services, that effectively it doesn't become viable for small players. And in this case, you would imagine, you know, small fruit producers of Brazil that currently export to Russia would be in that situation. And then finally, if you'll allow me, I mean, I'd like to take also a moment to reflect on in that framework of humanitarian sanctions and exemptions, there is also obviously going to be a question of social responsibility and what social responsibility means for companies. So American, Australian, Canadian, Japanese, and European companies are pulling out of the Russian market. Whether they will supply under humanitarian exemptions, whether humanitarian exemptions will apply to Russia. I mean, this is slightly ahead of ourselves, I think, at this stage. What we will see, however, is that there is going to be mounting public pressure from consumers to not supply Russia. Yeah, consumers ask that brands stand on the right side of history in this case, that they display a moral stance, that they stand up for democratic values and international law. And then effectively, it's that framework of democracy and international law that allows these own companies to strive. So effectively, early days, but a moment of great positioning and where decisions will count.
Emily, and just a follow-up clarification. When you talk about the fertilizers, I guess the impact within the country, within Brazil, because if we are not allowed to import those from Russia, then we may have an impact in our crops here in Brazil, and then export, and even in the domestic market in terms of supply and prices. And there's, I don't see much of a way out because we don't have where to buy this from. Do you see this? I mean, and this was not part of the plan, but it was a curiosity from our talk.
So Brazil won't be alone in that situation. The US, Europe, the spiraling of fertilizer prices will indeed have an impact on productivity, on prices. And in a way, it's going to push up those premiums even further if you have a tightening of supply as a result of not having those fertilizers readily disposable on the market, or being sold at a price which just becomes untenable for farmers. In Europe, there is a strategy, the farm to fork strategy, which is part of the European Green Deal, which aims to lower dependency, actually lower the use of fertilizers within the European Union. Perhaps this situation will create incentives to move quicker on that front, to implement those targets earlier, to become less dependent. But again, I think we're going to have to see, firstly, today, what the EU ministers, what their view is on impact of this, see how markets react. But I finish on a note of saying, isn't it extraordinary that where our fears during COVID was that we would be in an area of, you know, heightened commodity prices, that effectively it is this war that could have that effect again. You know, it's something that we've already seen, and we already know the consequences of it, from past episodes. But this time, cutting out a giant market the size of Russia is something that we have never seen. And so we are very much walking in the dark on this.
Yeah, and I believe in Brazil, we will have the same situation because we still have a national fertilizers plan to approve. And we're trying to speed up the process of not being so dependent, but that's medium term. In the short term, it's really dark, as you mentioned. So with that, I would like to say thank you to you for being here with us. I know it's soon because we will have more measures to understand better the scenario. So I would allow us to invite you again for another discussion, probably in a few weeks' time. So the WEETs can be updated upfront with the situation that is going on in Europe. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, despite the subject being so harsh for all of us.
Marina, Deborah, thank you so much for having me on this WITcast today. And to all the WITs out there, stay strong.
This was WITcast, the podcast of the Women Inside Trade Network. I hope you enjoyed our talk and keep following us at www.womeninsidetrade.com.